Why Genesis for the scripture reading, you might be asking, because we're obviously not preaching through Genesis. Honestly, what I wanted to do with that is purposely draw your attention back to Genesis as kind of a teaser for something that I really haven't had much time to do throughout Leviticus, and that is to point us back to creation. If you follow the imagery happening, beginning back at the instructions of how to build the tabernacle back in Exodus 20, there is so much creation imagery and messaging that is happening to the point that I would argue you cannot fully understand Exodus and Leviticus without looking back to creation. And I wanted to draw our attention to it today because this is a text that is honestly one of those sections of the Bible that we just look at and we're just like, okay, that's weird. Today we're looking at Leviticus 11 through 15. And I would argue again that without looking back to creation and talking about some of these things that I really haven't really had time to point to, we're going to really struggle to understand it. So today, first, I want to draw our attention, if you keep your finger, stay in Genesis. I'm going to talk a little bit about Genesis first as we point forward to our text for today. So today I want to draw first our attention to the two words that summarize what Adam's job was in the garden. We are told that he was to work it and to keep it. Now, the words being translated here are actually the same exact two words that are often used to summarize the duties of the priests. Adam was, in many ways, the first priest. And the role and function of the later priests are actually an echo and a continuation of the role and the jobs that he was called to. So that's the first echo that we have to understand. And why I point that out is that 11 through 15 comes right after the ordination and consecration of the priests and the first time that they actually perform their duties. The priesthood has literally just started. So this is the first thing we read right after the priesthood is consecrated and the tabernacle is now officially in use, which sounds an awful lot like Genesis 2 as well. Creation had just happened, which, again, teaser that I'll have to save later for a series through Exodus. There's the building of the tabernacle. Why it has such a crazy amount of detail when you read it is because God is purposely trying to draw attention to imagery that's happening, hearkening back to creation. The tabernacle is, in a way, a new creation, a new Eden. So the tabernacle had just been officially sanctioned and sanctified to now begin functioning. Just as in Genesis 2, God had just created. And then God breathed the breath of life into man and placed him in the garden, just as the priests had now just been ordained and consecrated to their service. So there's a lot of echoing that's happening right now. We also see a hearkening back to Genesis in the order of things addressed in our chapters today. Again, Leviticus 11 to 15. The first and only prohibition given to Adam concerned what he could or could not eat. Leviticus 11. The first prohibitions given from God to Moses and Aaron for the priests concerns what they could or could not eat. And then we read, after this prohibition to Adam, God says, "It is not good that man should be alone." And he creates Eve and brings Adam and Eve together to be the first couple to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That's picking up a little bit on Genesis 1 and 2 imagery. So Leviticus 12 discusses the ritual purity laws regarding childbirth. In Genesis 3, we then read of the curse and how it affected both mankind and the earth itself. So in Leviticus 13 to 15, we read mostly about effects of the curse, such as diseases, molds, and bodily discharges. I don't think this order was an accident. So this 11, specifically chapter 11, we look at it and you're like, why here? It's so random. These laws don't make sense to us. Why are we all of a sudden talking about food? I think there's a purposeful echoing back to the garden, to the first and only prohibition given to Adam. But now we're again talking about food. Now there are a lot more laws than Adam had, which is, again, one of the many, many, many ways in which Exodus and Leviticus are picking up on creation imagery and showing how the state of the world now is different. We are no longer in Eden. Now we have a much longer list of everything because the world has changed. That's one of the many ways we see it in the fact that you had one prohibition against food in Genesis 2. And now you have an entire chapter about food in Leviticus 11, which is also repeated, by the way, later in Deuteronomy. So again, I would argue that this order of chapters here that we see is not an accident. We also see in Genesis chapters 1 through 2 that God's creation was good. It was pure, whole, and full of life. God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was good. In fact, it was very good. This understanding of God and his creation as he intended it to be is one of, if not the, central idea in understanding what is going on in these chapters that sound, quite frankly, just plain weird to us. These chapters are that weird section of the Bible that, honestly, people who are trying to poke holes in the Bible will poke at it, and it confuses us because we don't understand them. These five chapters have to do with ritual purity, and I want to address them all together because I think the only way to understand them is by getting the big picture first so that the details make more sense. Because I am doing five chapters all at once, I will obviously not be talking about everything in these chapters. So, as always, if you have questions afterwards, please let me know. I may or may not have an answer for you. I may or may not just tell you to wait and I can do some research, and I may or may not also just include it in the Q&A at the end. I may also give you an answer and then say I will also address it in the Q&A. So, like, I'll let you know. But there will be a lot of stuff in these five chapters that I am just not going to address because I don't have time and I don't want to bore you all with a five-hour sermon. So our first chapter today, Leviticus chapter 11, is probably honestly one of the most baffling chapters in the Bible. We look at it, we read it, and we're either like, why? Or we're just like, I don't care, moving on, doesn't apply. So it's one of those chapters that it's just strange to us. It would be nice, honestly, if there was just one answer that I could give you that would clear up this chapter. But I'm not going to lie to you, it's not that easy. What I'm going to argue is that there is a network of reasons for these laws that all work together toward what is the summary reason for them given in verse 44. If you look at verse 44, near the end of the chapter, it says, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves or any swarming things that crawls," and it kind of goes on. "For I am the Lord the God. For I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." So you have all these do's and don'ts and restrictions and whatever about all these animals and how to clean certain things that come in contact with the animals. You have to break this, clean that, wash that. And at the end of it, it's, "You shall be holy." And we read that and we're like, this is food. Like, what does this have to do with holiness? Especially with how we tend to understand holiness. So the first question we have to address when we look at this chapter is, what does it mean exactly to be holy? If your theological upbringing has been anything like mine, you have probably at least at some point in your life understood this word to be equated with perfection. And what I mean by that is when you hear, "Be holy for I am holy," you hear, "Be perfect for I am perfect." And you sit there like, thanks. I'm done. I honestly, that's a good portion of my life. That's how I understood holiness. Now, whether or not that was actually how it was taught or that was just the short version of it that I walked away with, I'm not sure, honestly. Another way that it's commonly taught is to be set apart. Be set apart, because I am set apart. I would argue that's much closer to the biblical understanding. Needs to be nuanced a little bit still, but it's definitely going in the right direction. Already we have seen this word used in connection with objects or things associated with the tabernacle, such as the holy place, the holy of holies, the ground itself is holy ground, the high priest's crown, and this is just where the word holy is literally used in the text. That's, we've seen it associated with these things. In fact, not just the priests, but also their garments were to be consecrated as holy since they entered sacred space. So I haven't really spent much time on just this word itself, because I've kind of purposely let the use of it so far in the book try to hopefully shape our view of it. Because we've seen it associated with a lot of things that are not moral because they're inanimate objects. When we hear "be holy" as "be perfect," it is intrinsically and inherently related to morality. What we have to do is we have to get away from that idea, because that is honestly not how holiness is used in the Bible, not exclusively anyway. Morality can be included in the idea of holiness, but the idea of holiness doesn't start there. So you have to step away from that one-to-one relation with morality and step back further to see what holiness is. Because again, it's associated with inanimate objects. It's associated with the ground. The ground is not moral. The ground, I mean, topographically speaking, can be perfect, I guess, depending on what your preference is. But like, it can't be moral. It can't be good or evil ground. This is an important distinction to remember, especially in these five chapters. These chapters deal with animals that may or may not be eaten, how to cleanse dishes and other things used in food preparation, how to become purified after childbirth, after skin diseases, household mold, bodily discharges. Exciting stuff. None of these issues are moral. So again, you cannot understand holiness as a one-to-one relation to morality and come away with any coherent understanding of these chapters. Again, I'm not saying holiness cannot include the idea of morality, but it doesn't start there. Morality is included in the idea of being set apart, consecrated, sanctified, but that's one aspect of it, and that aspect of it is not being addressed here in this text. So I want to start off with that clarification, just so we're all on the same page with what's going on with all this holiness language here. And the fact that these issues are not moral is made most obvious by the solutions to most of them that we see. Many of the solutions are simply time, doing the laundry, or taking a bath. That's the solution. And that would not be a good solution for a moral issue. But it's a good solution for a ritually unclean issue. Now, you will see that a few references to the sin offering, but again, the context that you see the person having to bring the sin offering and the reason they have to bring it are why I mentioned earlier when we talked about the sin offering, that it'd be much better to understand the sin offering as a purification, or honestly, a decontamination offering. Because it is detoxing you, decontaminating you from the ritual impurity that you've accrued through certain things. So again, the sin offering, read that as purification offering when you see it in these chapters. So all that to say, when we ask why of these food laws and everything in these five chapters, what we should really be asking, as we've asked for everything so far in this book, what is the message being given? Because again, this isn't about morality. What is the message about holiness, about being set apart, about being consecrated? What is God trying to tell the Israelites through these instructions that are summarized as being holy and being set apart? What is the theological and cultural messaging that would result in that sort of understanding that if I do these things, I am holy, set apart, just like God, because God is the one calling me to do these things? So what messaging, what is the relation here? That what is this stuff, doing this stuff in this way, teach about God? That if I do it this way, I am being a message, and what is happening is all being a message about God. What is the relation here? That's the question that we should be trying to answer as we look at these chapters. So as we look first at the food laws in 11, I would argue that there are multiple messages that are all working together. You might read some sources that try to simplify chapter 11 and like, well, this is the one reason why you have all of these prohibition against certain animals and certain things you have to do or don't do. And honestly, if you look too deeply into any one of them, you'll realize that there is a verse or a section or a category of animals that just doesn't fit. So I would argue it's not one message going on. And that's honestly, like, that's not just a Bible thing. That's a life thing. It's like, it's rarely ever just one answer to why somebody does something. It's usually kind of a network of answers that all work together. The first thing to notice as we seek to find out what these messages are is to notice that there are no laws for plants. These laws only relate to living things. This is because of the importance and the messaging of blood that we have talked about many times already. These living things, now whether or not, scientifically speaking, they technically have like blood like we do, the understanding is that they have life force fluids in them. Again, you got to think like ancient mindset, just kind of that category. These beings have life force stuff inside of them. And they viewed plants differently than that. So that's why this chapter addresses living things specifically. And this is particularly obvious, this relation to and this view of the blood here, that there's probably blood messaging going on. This becomes particularly obvious in the list of forbidden birds and sea creatures. Many of the ones that you cannot eat and are unclean are scavengers, which by the very nature of how they get their food come into contact with carcasses, which are considered one of the highest forms of impurity in this whole system. The logic and message then is that they are not to be eaten since they are made unclean through their contact with dead animals by the very nature of how they get their food. They are also obviously not draining the blood properly when they go get their food. They're not following like the ritual things like when Israelites can eat a dead animal, they have to drain the blood properly and bury it in the dirt and all the stuff if they're out in the field. Like, animals aren't going to do that. So, like, obviously there's some impurity involved here, and therefore they are not to be eaten. Another trail of logic with this, again, the life force understanding, is that eating these animals, because they didn't follow the ritual purities of, like, draining blood and stuff like that, this could, in a way, be used as a loophole by Israelites to gain life force from an animal. It's like, well, I drained the blood of this scavenger, but they didn't drain the blood of theirs, so I'm probably gaining life force from that. So basically, this is, again, God putting up walls to wrong understanding of how life and the source of life and all that stuff works. So this not only blocks off the impurity of eating an animal that's been in contact with a dead carcass, but it's also blocking off the wrong thinking that would say I can gain life force from eating something that's eaten something else, even if I'm technically following our rules by eating this animal they didn't, so I'm still getting life force. So you see how there's like, in the ancient mindset, there's a logic there that could have been followed that God's just saying, no, you don't do that. But this explanation obviously doesn't cover all of the forbidden animals. So what other messages are we being given? Another message has to do with purity. Now this seems weird because when you read the list, you're like, what does any of that have to do with purity? You have to think of purity of type or purity of animal class. What I mean is that some of the forbidden animals don't quite fit into a certain category. They are in a way or a crossover or an animal that's missing something. Now, a quick word here. Technically speaking, scientifically, like modern science speaking, you have to realize that the stuff going on, the classifications going on in this chapter, don't follow modern science. They follow ancient observational science. Like, these are the animal class categories as they were categorized to the ancient people, because they didn't have all of the scientific stuff that we have now. A good example of this, to prove my point, is basically seen in the badger and the hare, which are grouped, which they don't use this word, but like basically at the beginning here, they're grouped in ruminants, which ruminants are animals that chew the cud. They have multiple stomachs. Rock badger and hare don't have multiple stomachs, but they do have the appearance of chewing for a long time. So again, to the ancient observation, they were ruminants, but to us, they aren't. So it's some people would poke holes at this and be like, well, that classification's wrong. It's like, well, yeah, how we classify it, but like they were right by how they classified it. So again, we can't impose modern things on the Bible. It's just like when we look at a genre in the Bible and we're like, okay, this is a history or whatever, so therefore it should follow our modern criterion of how we write in that genre. It's like, well, that's not fair, because that's not how the Bible is written in its genre, in its time. So it's the same thing with some of the science stuff that happens. Like, they were doing good science of their day, whether or not ours agrees with it. So that's just a kind of a quick aside about that. Some animals in this chapter are forbidden because they are not seen as pure forms of their class. Again, they're either missing something or being a mixture of two classes. And that's where the first few verses there are a great example, because it's basically the whole split hoof and chew the cud, and like, well, this one has this but not this, or this but not this. And it's like, that's why you see that. Because essentially what's the message being given is this animal isn't a pure example. of that class. So therefore, they aren't to be eaten because they are seen as some sort of a mixture or impurity. And God is to be associated with purity and wholeness. Another message is something that we have seen come into play in most of this book so far, a polemic against pagan ritual practices. This is most likely the best way to understand why the pig, which if you follow the first few verses, is pointed out to fail the purity message. But honestly, if you look at it, there's nothing special about the pig. And yet, it is the animal that we all associate with Jewish kosher laws that you don't eat. Like, there's nothing special about it in these verses that would point it out to be that. But I would argue that the way to understand how that happened historically is that, one, it fails the purity class thing in the first few verses there. But there's also an additional layer of messaging going on, specifically with the pig. And what that is that the evidence suggests that in the ancient world, pigs were actually sacrificed in cultures in rituals associated with underworld deities, and also in rituals that included child sacrifice. So specifically the pig not only has this failure of class impurity, but also has some associations with rituals that God in no way wants his people to be a part of at all. You don't worship underworld deities, you don't worship things associated with death, and you don't do child sacrifice. God has really, really strong language about child sacrifice multiple places in his word. So there is like an extra layer of prohibition against the pig. And that's probably why it has been kind of singled out as one of the more extreme offenses. These messages all work together to teach, just like Genesis 1 to 2, that God is a God of life, wholeness, and purity. This is also why so many details are given about tracing and cleansing any form of contact or contamination with unclean animals and carcasses. Everything must be cleansed so that the person who was in contact with any of those things does not bring any association with death or impurity with them to the tabernacle. Because again, you have to think of the messaging. Why on earth would we take so much time talking about clean this pot, clean this oven, clean this whatever? It's like, well, because you as the person are in that house touching that thing, and then you want to go to the tabernacle, which is holy ground and sacred space. And you can't bring any association with impurity, unwholeness, or death with you there and be accepted because of the message that's being given that God is the God of purity, wholeness, and life. This is made explicitly clear at the end of chapter 15 in verse 31, where it says, "Thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst." Which is, again, the reasoning behind this logic here, though. Like, why do you go to these ridiculous extents to clean everything? It's so that you don't bring it with you when you come to the tabernacle. So that's Leviticus 11. Chapters 12 through 15 all deal with physical issues that result in ritual impurity. Like I mentioned earlier, none of these issues have to do with sin. I want us to first look at and think about these chapters as a whole, and then I will address some specific issues. In these chapters, yet again, theological and cultural messaging is being given. Most issues in these chapters have to do with the loss of life force fluids. Or someone is in the state of unwholeness because they've lost something from themselves. These two issues caused ritual impurity because, again, God is seen as the God of life and wholeness. Also notice that most causes of unholiness came from the body, something that everybody, regardless of class or profession, had. Even the priests at times could become ritually unclean. This is different than other cultures around Israel in which one could become unholy or unclean from contact with someone of another class or of a foreigner. Flashing forward to the New Testament real briefly here, this is one of the things that the Pharisees got wrong in their teachings about the law code. Since they considered themselves to become ritually unclean after contact with a common person, which was a fellow Israelite. This difference from cultures around them was God already planting the seed that his gospel is for everyone, regardless of class or nationality. Because again, this impurity didn't come through contact with people by and large. Now, obviously, there are caveats like this person had this disease or whatever, like it is. But you as just a person can become impure because of different things that your body does. What this is teaching is like the universal application of this, and that's why, one of the many reasons why, Jesus got so mad at the Pharisees for how they were teaching about ritual impurity and uncleanness, is that they were teaching that not only was there this difference between like the priests and the teachers and the people, but they were adding these extra layers of like, you as people are just unclean and as a rule. That's just who you are. And the whole point of Leviticus is that you are like my royal priesthood as a whole nation. You are my kingdom. And unless you do these things, you are allowed into sacred space. Now, obviously, the people were only allowed so far, but the people as a whole, just as their default status, shouldn't have been viewed the way that the Pharisees were viewing them, where just simply by contact they became unclean. And Jesus was angry at them because they were putting all these bars up to people understanding truth and understanding God. So that's kind of just a quick flash forward to the New Testament, some things here about how this stuff gets brought forward. But getting into more specific issues, within the framework of theological and cultural messaging, how can we better understand some of these strange or seemingly controversial sections of these chapters? I want to first look at chapter 12. It's actually the shortest chapter in this group. This is the chapter on childbirth and the process of purification after a woman gives birth. The first thing to consider is the reason for the impurity to begin with. Remember in the grain offering how we talked about how the word for honey, that also refers to like the nectar or the juice of fruit, and how this, whatever this word is, this thing was not allowed on the offering unless it was given as a first fruit offering. This word used for honey or fruit nectar, it's associated with the idea of excretion or loss, whether it's from the bee or the fruit, respectively. Because the bee basically vomits the nectar to create honey. The fruit, if you squeeze it, loses juice. So there's a loss. The thing is no longer whole, in a manner of speaking. So here, the loss of blood and body fluid during birth causes a woman to become ritually unclean. She is, in a sense, temporarily unwhole because she has lost some of the kind of life force fluids that were inside of her. So that's why there is this impurity. The second thing to consider is the length of the impurity. And there are a couple things going on here that we should think about. So the first thing to consider is why so long? Whether it's a boy or a girl, the woman is unclean at least for 40 days. There are a couple things going on here. First, not to get too graphic, but like there's still healing happening for usually about a month or so. So like that's just a logistical thing there. And the minimum kind of being the 40 days. And then second, declaring the new mother unclean actually, and this is something that we don't really think about in our modern context, but actually it kept her protected in a more isolated, watched over environment where she's not going anywhere. She's staying in a certain place so that people have eyes on her and able to help her in an ancient environment that had a very high child and mother mortality rate. There is not only the practical measure of there's still some healing happening, so she is still unclean, but there's also the protective measure of we live in an ancient context that has a giant mortality rate related to this time period, the first couple months after a birth happens. So we want to protect the mother. So what's actually interesting is that, especially in this chapter, some of the stuff that we view as sexist is actually honoring women once you understand what's happening here and put it in its ancient context. The second thing about this length of time is why are the periods for sons and daughters different? This is another thing that people point at, and they're like, well, that's sexist, because it's only 40 days for a boy, and it's about 80 days for a girl. So it's like, okay, well, are girls viewed as inferior because like you take longer to be purified after you have a girl? Or like, what's going on? Are girls viewed as more unclean because you have to have more cleansing time to decontaminate yourself from them? So this is a common area that people poke at as a sexist thing in the Levitical code. So there are a few things to consider here. The number of days for purification for a daughter is possibly longer because they were thought to need more protection. So honestly, one way to view it is that it's actually more honoring to give more time. It gives the mother more time to heal and not be required to do much of anything but rest. Also, one layer that's probably going on, now you have to kind of caveat this one because the messaging gets a little mixed, but in the ancient context, specifically the birth of a daughter, was viewed as very dangerous. Because of the high mortality rates with children and mothers, it was thought that a new mother is under extra attack by the world and by demonic forces. Specifically with a daughter, because a daughter is another source of life that the forces of death would fight against. So in a very real way, this is God, he is and isn't kind of honoring that fear there. But in reality, I would argue it's just an extra layer of honoring and protection for the birth of a daughter specifically. What I would argue is just as important, if not even maybe the higher reason for the disparity of days, is that according to the ancient understanding, there's all sorts of medical stuff that walks through this, but the general consensus on how they viewed the formation of the embryo was that a male embryo took about 40 days to form and a female embryo took about 80 days to form. So therefore, if you start at those points, the purification days make sense because all you're doing is completing the term by starting at the two different points. So it's actually not at all that the girl, the daughter, is viewed as any less or inferior or anything like that. It's just that she was formed differently. So the days are different. So there's that ancient understanding as well about even just kind of the pre-scientific understanding of the formation of the embryo. So there are, again, a couple different factors going on there. And just another thing to notice, and this one is switching over to the son. Notice also that the mother is considered clean for just one day on the eighth day so that she can participate in the circumcision ceremony. It's kind of this exception that's granted her so that she can become part of this, which is a very culturally important day. Now, she was still, culturally speaking, supposed to be pretty careful and not like contaminate stuff, especially if she's still healing or whatever. But she was allowed that exception to go participate in that and then go return to isolation for the next 33 days. So I think that's a pretty cool caveat. So all that to say, when we look at chapter 12, we look at this as kind of this random, like the days are different, seems kind of controversial, seems kind of sexist. And honestly, once you understand what's actually going on here, especially to the ancient mindset, there is actually this honoring that is happening to the mother, whether it's a son or a daughter. And honestly, there's almost more honor and protection given to the birth of a daughter. We view it as sexist, and they would have actually viewed it as the exact opposite of how we look at it from our eyes. And then as far as the remaining chapters go, I'm just going to give a few observations real quick. The first thing to notice is that the word translated, you might see leprosy as your header, you might see leprous diseases, you might see a few different things. This word actually refers to several different skin diseases. So like when you see, especially like dramatic presentations of this, where it's like the people are just like losing stuff left and right, it's like, well, that's may or may not have been right. And if you follow what's happening with a lot of these things, it's like it doesn't seem like it was nearly to that extent with some of these skin diseases that were happening. So when you read leprous disease or leprosy or whatever, just think skin disease. It's just a general category that may or may not be really bad. It could be like just a little one or two things on your skin. It could be like, yeah, you are losing stuff because you do have straight up leprosy. But there's a scale there. And that's why you see differences with how stuff is treated, because it's all about where it kind of falls in the various diseases that could be being talked about. So that's just kind of like a thing to think about as we're reading through the specific words being used. Second, also notice that the procedures are more about ritual cleansing than about healing. It's easy to read this stuff and get confused. Like, well, that wouldn't help at all. I mean, like, the isolation kind of helps because you don't spread it. And then, like, water, I mean, to us now, we're like, well, you should also probably have soap in there and stuff like that. But, like, they only had access to so much stuff. But they had, like, ointments and stuff they could be using. But anyways, you'll notice that all this stuff here, this isn't really talking about the medicinal track of these people. This is talking about the ritual cleansing track of these people. It has nothing to say about what the people are supposed to eat during these times. It has nothing to say about what other additional things could not be being given to these people during this time. So that's also another point of confusion that comes up with these chapters, is that, like, well, this is a horrible medical diagnostic for these people. It's like, well, that's not the point. Like, this isn't talking about how you treat these people. This is talking about how you purify these people to be able to enter sacred space after they've had a skin disease, or to know kind of where they fall on the timeline. So when you look at this and get confused or you get criticized because of that aspect of these chapters, you can just simply be like, well, that wasn't the point of these chapters. Third, notice that in 13, verses 45 to 46, The person with the disease is essentially to perform acts of mourning while they are living outside the camp. They're essentially mourning, honestly, their own death. What is interesting, though, is that if you follow a lot of this stuff, like, they're going to quickly get back into the camp. So this isn't like they're going to be out there forever and die out there. A lot of these instances are actually, like, they're just temporarily outside of the camp and then they're back in. But while they're temporarily outside of the camp, they're supposed to be doing these visible mourning rituals. And what that was is even that was messaging that it is a type of death to be separated from God and from the covenant blessings of being in camp with him and his people and being where the tabernacle is, to be excluded from that outside of the camp, an extra layer away from the tabernacle, was a form of death, a separation from God. Fourth and lastly, notice again that none of these issues, like I mentioned a few times already, none of these issues are moral issues. They are natural parts of life. They are pregnancy, birth, menstruation, skin diseases, various discharges, and even just house mold. These rituals in these chapters have nothing to do with the character of the person, but they do have something to teach us about the character of God. That is what we should be looking for. The point of all this is not a negative condemnation of the person, but rather a positive teaching about the perfection and completeness of God and the original creation order as the ideal. God's new Eden, the tabernacle, was to be associated with life, not death, and wholeness and purity, not impurity and incompleteness. The weird stuff in these chapters only seems weird to us because we don't hear and see the messaging being given as clearly as the Israelites would have seen it. This leads to the primary application for today. We must be humble when we look at passages in the Bible that seem weird and unintelligible to us. People try to poke holes at the Bible. They often point to passages like this as nonsense or sexist or whatever else they want to label it as. These passages can also shake our faith by causing us to question the goodness, the character, or even the sanity of God. We have to remember that the Bible was written for us, but it was not written to us. And sometimes it takes work and patience to make sense of a difficult passage. Even the Israelites were called in their own context to teach these things to each other. Some of the stuff was difficult, multi-layered messaging that was going on, and that's why parents were called to teach their children. Priests were called to study the law and to teach it. So even in their own context, they had to teach it to each other. We have more work cut out for us to mine the depths of these passages. But even still, their truths are worth the work because they hold blessing and teaching for us. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that even the weird passages in your word are important. I thank you that there is no part of your word that is wasted. I thank you that you have something to teach us from every page we turn to. And that even here, as we look at these strange ritual laws, that you point back, you point us back to your creation and to you, how you are perfect and whole and pure, and how we live in a world that is not anymore. It is not as you intended it. To be is not how you created it to be, but it is a world that you are redeeming to yourself, and that everything about this world ought to draw us to you. And I thank you for the messaging that you gave to the Israelites at this time, and I thank you that you still, in different ways, give the same message to us, and that we can learn to see it even back in their time, to realize that you have been giving the same message all along. Pray this in your name. Amen.